We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast. It is Thursday, October 8th. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. We are into week five of the NFL season, so we've got our first round of bye weeks starting to kick in here. We got a pretty interesting slate of games to get into here. We're going to get into every single game on this week's slate, breaking it down from every angle. You know how we do things around here. Mario, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you doing, John?
I'm well. The weather's nice. A nice crisp fall is upon us. It's been a little bit warmer than it usually is this time of year here. And, you know, outside of football, been enjoying just being able to just mainline baseball for like 10 hours a day these last couple of days. I know that isn't going to last too much longer here, but enjoying the playoff baseball. I know that the Brewers bowed out, unfortunately, a little bit earlier, but it's been pretty entertaining baseball on top of it. But we'll keep it on locked on football here for this podcast. Let's get things started here. Thursday night game, we have the Tampa Bay Buccaneers going into Chicago to face off against those Chicago Bears. The Bucs are 3.5-point favorites in this one. I think that might have moved a little bit. I believe the Bucs were 4.5-point favorites a little bit earlier on in the week, but things have trended towards the Bears a little bit because there are so many injuries when it comes to this Buccaneers team, specifically on the offensive side of the ball. So between Fournette having the ankle, LeSean McCoy being out, O.J. Howard blowing his Achilles on Sunday, and then you also have, I think, Justin Watson is dinged up as well. And even the guys that are likely to play are also going to be dealing with some stuff with Mike Evans dealing with an injury, Scotty Miller as well, Evans with the ankle and Scotty Miller with the hip and the groin issue. That's a lot of firepower that's going to be limited or out for Tom Brady on a short week on Thursday.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess you would have some cause for, skepticism, enduring skepticism of Ronald Jones, Keyshawn Vaughn, the Tampa Bay running game, in other words. So it is fair to kind of look at this matchup and see on one side, yes, the Bears offense is dubious at best, probably bad, and the Tampa Bay defense could be one of the best in the league. So you look at that and it's like, well, that's one big advantage in this matchup. And yet, if you look at the offense for Tampa Bay, it's bleak enough that, then the Chicago Bears defense is good enough, especially in a setting like this, I would guess on a short week, that you can imagine the advantage that the Buccaneers have on their defense versus the Bears offense might not mean as much as it would in other cases, because you still need to score points, and just stopping the other team from scoring doesn't necessarily mean you are scoring yourself, or that your offense isn't putting the defense on a short field with a turnover here and there. So I guess things like that tend to go wrong for the visiting team more often than the home team. So maybe that's the reason that there's more money coming in at the last second for the Bears here. So yeah, I mean, I think Tyler Johnson is a really good prospect at receiver, and I think the NFL was basically wrong to let him fall into the fifth round of the draft like they did. But it's one of those things, like, even if I think he's good, what are the odds that he's actually going to be prepared for a sort of short notice, a difficult setting like this, especially because he's going to go against good corners like Kyle Fuller and Jalen Johnson. So there's a lot of dead ends for the Buccaneers, just even though the Bears offense looks pretty hopeless on the other side.
Yeah, the Bears have been one of my several kryptonites this year. I can't seem to figure them out. When I back them, they it goes horribly wrong. When I'm off them, they tend to burn me. At least that's how it's been through these first 4 weeks. And last week, it was a weird confluence, because I'm also completely unable to get a read on Indianapolis as well, because I'm so low on Philip Rivers, but they keep winning. Other than that first week, so like that was just like a nightmare scenario for my brain, where I just could not figure out how that game was going to go. Obviously, it didn't go well, mostly for the Bears in that one, but there's some frustrating stuff on the Indianapolis side as well. But circling back to this game, it's hard to have a whole lot of optimism about this Bears offense going against this Bucs defense that, like you said, really is among the best in the league. So I think this is going to be an abnormal game for the Bucs. It's probably not what they want to do most of the time, but I think they have what it takes to just win on defense and just kind of grinding this one out in a very low scoring contest. So I think this could be like a 20-17 Bucs type of outcome here.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like the under, which, like, I'm surprised it was an over 40 for this game, let alone 45, down to 44 and a half, I guess, at the moment. I would take the under there. And yeah, I guess Allen Robinson can do some hero stuff for the Bears. He tends to, actually. It's just that even if he does, it's hard to see how the Bears put up the sum on offense necessary to win, unless Tom Brady completely falls apart, which it could happen. He wasn't as good against the Chargers as his numbers looked. There was some pretty sloppy stretches for him in between the five touchdowns, just some big plays kind of showing up opportunistically for him. But he was closer to his baseline than those numbers look, and in this setting, he'll be well below his baseline. But yeah, I still would take the Tampa Bay side, because I just think, whereas the Bears' defense is merely good and pertinently probably not as good against the run as they've been in most recent years, and the Buccaneers' defense is truly great. And I think if they need to get Ronald Jones and even Keyshawn Vaughn to get them, that one field goal margin, I think they can do it.
Okay. All right. That definitely makes sense. And then if you're going into the showdown slate tonight, are you throwing in a Tyler Johnson or a Keyshawn Vaughn?
Maybe both,
There you
because
go.
I mean, Ronald Jones is, I guess, if you're making like multiple lineups, you want to get primary exposure to him. I wouldn't be going at the passing game a whole lot. So if I did, yeah, maybe I would just go with one of Johnson or Brait or Gronk, I think I'd try to like get the most of what Brady does without actually investing in Brady and hope that one of those guys just kind of gets a little bit of the lead on the rest, because yeah, it's got to happen mostly on the ground. Like Ronald Jones has to step up in this game for Tampa Bay to win.
Yeah. I do like dumpster diving in my showdown lineups. I've really gotten into them this year. And last week the Jeff Smith thing reminded me very much of like a college football DFS type of situation where like Rich Cimini, one of the Jets beat writers, is like, yeah, so this guy Jeff Smith is starting, it looks like. And I'm like, wait a second. And then I check DraftKings and he's, you know, like basically at the minimum price, basically free to have in your lineup, and he ends up having that great game. So I feel like with all those injuries on the Bucks, you might run into a scenario similar to last week, and you can find this week's Jeff Smith on the Bucks, and hopefully it's Tyler Johnson.
If it's not him, in the event that Scott Miller and – well, we know Godwin and Watson are out, but if Scott Miller is also out, then Jaden Mickens might be the guy too. He would probably be their slot receiver, and Johnson would probably be outside opposite Evans. But, yeah, Mickens would run against Buster Skrine, who is a much worse corner than Jalen Johnson or Kyle Fuller are.
Okay, that is definitely a good note there, and Brady obviously likes to go to the slot too, so keep that in mind for your showdown lineups as we get a little bit closer to kickoff there. Let's get on to our next matchup. Let's get into the Sunday slate. We got an NFC South battle between the Falcons and the Panthers. The Falcons looked pretty lifeless Monday night against the Packers. The Panthers showing a lot more punch over these last 2 weeks than I think any of us would have expected, especially without Christian McCaffrey. Unfortunately, feeding the RBs don't matter, folks, getting them their feed for the week. Anyway, Falcons... 1.5-point favorites at home against the Panthers. What's going on here?
Well, it's hard to tell whether anything is setting up good for Julio. It doesn't really sound that promising to this point. I'm not really assuming he'll play. If he does, I'm pretty sure it'll be it was stupid that they played him last week. You could see he was hurt when he was playing. And then Dirk Koetter just gets dumber every single day of his life and he was calling just the stupidest sequences of plays. It was truly maddening to me. But yeah, he's like calling these lopsided passing formations all to the right side of the offense, which is away from Kevin King. So it was like he was choosing to run Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley against Jair Alexander and Chandon Sullivan instead of Kevin King, who you just cannot lose against. Like, he always fails if you just throw at him. And Dirk Koetter just instead got Julio hurt again on a screen pass right into the teeth of the toughest part of the Green Bay defense. Like, these guys need to start getting fired. It's a hazard to their own intelligence if they're left in these positions of authority, because they just rot their brains there and get dumber all the time. Anyway, I think he hurt Julio on that play, and it was a doomed play design from the start. And Julio and Julio's investors get to pay whatever the misdirected karmic price for that ridiculous folly on Koetter's part. So I'm not assuming Julio plays. Calvin Ridley, I thought more or less looked okay in that game. He was just like a bad setup for him, getting no doubt a lot of Jair attention and just barely missing on that one toss that was on like the first drive, and he had a drop later or something like that. So he should bounce back. And I think, no one in this Carolina secondary can really cover him. I do think that Phil Snow, the defensive coordinator for the Panthers, is pretty good. I noticed they're using some kind of novel and varied sort of secondary looks, like kind of doing some amoeba stuff using Jeremy Chinn, that second round safety. Like, I guess he hasn't done great or anything, but they're basically using him as a rover. And so it kind of looks like a linebacker, kind of looks like a slot corner. Don't really have a recent use of this position in the NFL. It was always more of like a Virginia Tech kind of defense, 4-4 kind of look, 5-2 kind of stuff. And they're doing all that, and they're switching things up a lot from week to week. Like, I think they were using Rasul Douglas as a shadow corner on DeAndre Hopkins last week, but I don't think that's because they'll do that all the time. And like, specifically, I don't think they'll do that for Ridley. I do think that if Julio plays, Rasul Douglas will shadow him, because they're both like oversized basically at their position. And Rasul Douglas it's kind of like a James Bradbury thing. Like, he might match up pretty well with big receivers. So he might do well against like Mike Evans's and Julio Jones's, but against Calvin Ridley, that's when Rasul Douglas starts to look like the bad Eagles Rasul Douglas, because he just can't run that much. Like, he needs to be able to leverage his like height and arm length into the playing of the position of cornerback. And if you put Ridley on him, he can't really do that. He's just kind of like laterally moving and tripping over himself. So I think Ridley can beat him pretty easily. Dante Jackson lines up more easily with Ridley, but I don't know that he would shadow Ridley, because if they shadow Ridley with Dante Jackson, then that leaves Rasul Douglas to cover Zacchaeus in the event that Julio is out, and Zacchaeus can absolutely just spin Douglas in circles. So I think that there are ways for the Falcons to start making consistent damage against this defense, but Julio's availability throws certainly a question mark over that, and I don't trust Cutter to outsmart anyone, especially Phil Snow, who I think, even though he's on a defense that won't be good this year, I think Snow is probably one of the better defensive coordinators out there.
Okay, interesting. And then just rounding things out as far as this Falcons personnel is concerned, is Zacchaeus happening?
Well, that one catch that he had was just one that, like, I can't remember if it tipped off of a player in front of him. It was like almost intercepted, and he was behind the guy and caught it, and it wasn't going to Zacchaeus, I don't think. So that one play was lucky. It's almost like they should count it as a catch but not a target. But anyway, he was, I think, you know, like some of those catches, I'll admit, were just kind of like low difficulty ones because Ryan wasn't really pushing the ball up the field. But Zacchaeus has a long history of production from Virginia, and he's a totally adequate athlete, neither of which is really the case for Russell Gage. Like, I'll admit he's better this year. He looks good enough, I guess. Mm-hmm. But Zacchaeus can do anything he can, and there are plenty of things Gage can't do that Zacchaeus can. So, but he'll be running outside. It'll be Gage in the slot, even if Julio is out. And I don't think it's a great matchup for Gage. I guess he'll mostly see Corn Elder and Jeremy Chin, but I don't know. I still don't think Gage is anything more than like a baseline rider, and if that. And I think Zacchaeus, I mean, what he did at Virginia, is it just speaks for itself. Like, Gage could not do anything until basically week one of this year in his entire career of playing receiver. So I'm definitely more inclined to buy Zacchaeus. And again, if he's on Rasul Douglas at 6'2", 210 or whatever, running that 4.6, he does not have like the leg build to cover a player like Zacchaeus, being as short and quick and explosive as he is. Like, Rasul Douglas will literally cross his legs and trip if he tries to cover Zacchaeus all game.
Okay. And then two more. What do you do with Hayden Hurst at this point?
You just got to keep waiting. Like, the Packers probably are good at dealing with people like him, just because I know Chandon Sullivan got hurt, but it's like they got the two safeties who are basically both free safeties, and Chandon Sullivan really good in the middle. I think Hurst has sort of like an unfair expectation of plugging into what Hooper did. And it's not even theoretically what Hurst is supposed to be. Hurst is a different kind of player. He might need things a little more set up for him because he doesn't really seem to dictate targets. It's like he's one of those guys who, when you target him, he's efficient and even explosive sometimes, but he can't really create the situation himself where he gets that target. So I wouldn't expect him to be some kind of like world beater. Like, he'll never take up a Darren Waller kind of role in an offense, but when the targets happen, they should be efficient, and you know, he's not going to go forever without getting targets. Especially this might be a good spot for Hayden Hurst. Like, Jeremy Chin might be on Hurst for the most part, and Chin, you know, he's coming from Southern Illinois. I don't even know if he was a safety there, if he was a linebacker, I can't remember, but like he's learning a new position. Basically, he's playing Rover. And, you know, as far as fifth game assignments go, Hayden Hurst is definitely an intimidating one for a guy like him.
Okay. And then let's hit Todd Gurley real quick and then get on the Panther side of this.
I mean, yeah, he looks like Dallas Cowboys Eddie George or something. Like, he looks so slow. It's kind of like I know it's a hack bit at this point, but God, it is true. He is, to be fair, looking pretty strong. Like, he's definitely breaking tackles, but it's just like, man, I don't know if you even are as fast as Adrian Peterson is right now. Like, that guy's running a 4.75, and I'm watching Gurley play, and I'm like, I don't know if he clears 4.65 right now, which is insane because he used to be legitimately pretty fast. Mm-hmm. So he's lost something, and that makes me worry that he's going to keep losing stuff as the season goes along. But
they are like holding him out for entire drives at a time to like keep him up, and he's still looking like that.
Yeah, I don't have any reassuring case studies to recall. Like, I don't remember someone looking like him and then all of a sudden being like, I feel 10 years younger all of a sudden, which within in his case, it's like he's only like 27 or something.
Yeah, the Mr. Burns so treatment.
Yeah, so it's not great. And the good news for his fantasy investors, though, is because the Falcons are such a mismanaged, sub-circus sort of endeavor, it's like they don't have any better things to do. Like they're so stupid. Like this team is so bad at talent evaluation that they threw basically all of their backup personnel equity into Brian Hill and Russell Gage. And it's like, if you think those two are like worthwhile NFL prospects, you know, worth spending project time on, then you are going to have bad players. Like you're going to have a few good players like Julio and Calvin Ridley if you're lucky, but besides them, you've mismanaged everything. And now if Todd Gurley turns out to be old and busted, you don't have any recourse unless you consider Brian Hill recourse, which I don't. I think he's not any good. Like everything about them just is so mismanaged. It's so infuriating. But I think Gurley is a sell high in fantasy all the same, because it's like those touchdowns might not keep happening. And if you got a guy who's getting lots of carries and no yardage, no touchdowns, and everybody already is looking for the failure, everybody's waiting for Gurley to completely turn to dust. So you won't get any like generous interpretation of your offers if he starts having a string of bad games.
For sure. And then on the Panthers side, I mean, this should be pretty much green lights for all the major players here going up against the Falcons.
Yeah, it's a great matchup for all three receivers. How they choose to use them is, I guess, less clear, but it seems like Curtis Samuel is going to be completely inverse of what he should be doing. He should be playing the position that DJ Moore is playing. DJ Moore should be playing, the Curtis Samuel one, and Robbie Anderson should keep playing the one that he's been playing, but they should just be making Samuel and Moore more productive than they've been by the virtue of putting them in their proper positions. But it seems like Matt Rhule is basically just trying to make Robbie Anderson their number one receiver. And I think Robbie Anderson's good, but I don't think DJ Moore is going to have the season anyone hoped for, because I don't think Matt Rhule cares about making him that player.
That's unfortunate. So, I mean, that's a,
just crony stuff. And I want to mention real quickly, is like, people look around the NFL and, you know, they hear about people pointing out racism and coaching hires and stuff like that, and the way that black quarterbacks versus white quarterbacks are treated. And sometimes that stuff can happen less because of like intentional racism and more just because of cronyism. And it's a really interesting example that Robbie Anderson, of all people, is an example of this coaching cronyism, because it's like we know he's not as good as DJ Moore. Like I like Robbie Anderson. I think he's quite good. And the Jets screwed up by letting him waste away the way that he did, and then letting him walk the way that they let him go. But they're choosing to make Robbie Anderson a bigger player than DJ Moore just because Matt Rhule knows Robbie Anderson and trusts him and stuff. And so it's like, when you have that kind of cronyism happening left and right, and you have a society that's built on an unequal distribution of resources on the basis of demographics, then just letting things play out over time will have over time an accumulating like discriminant effect. And it's like, this is an innocuous case of it, because there's no, you know, discrimination happening that anyone can tell. But it's like, you could imagine if the demographics were different, it would basically look like it was being done on that basis. But it's actually just a classic case of, look, good old boys club looking out for your buddy. That's all it is in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, Anderson has been getting a surprising amount of action in that offense, especially relative to DJ Moore. That has been one of the surprising developments under this new coaching regime under Matt Rhule. Let's get on over to the Bengals versus the Ravens. Lamar Jackson dealing with that knee issue, apparently. So that kind of freezes the betting market on this game, at least for the time being. I think it's supposed to be minor when it comes to Jackson. If Jackson is good to go, how do you see this game shaking out?
Well, if I was the Ravens, I'd try to just have it have a result that doesn't really hinge on Lamar Jackson. Like, they should be able to just kind of run over this Bengals defense, and the Ravens defense should be good enough to kind of keep under control whatever threat might be posed by the Bengals offense. And there might not be much of a threat posed by the Bengals offense, but the Ravens have this backfield with Mark Ingram, J.K. Dobbins, and Gus Edwards. And Lamar Jackson, I know, is a dangerous runner, and it's part of what makes the structure of the offense like that rushing threat. But in a one-off context like this, it should be the sort of setting where the Ravens just say, Like we're basically foregoing this one part that we normally have in our offense, and we're going to bank on the fact that we've got still an offensive line that can clear room in the running game for our, you know, various capable running backs, and we'll otherwise kind of just like bank on the other team's offensive line problems, kind of subsidizing whatever we give up by forfeiting the Lamar Jackson run threat, because that Bengals offensive line is going to keep being bad. And Calais Campbell, Derek Wolf, like I said this before, those are the kind of guys who you really need to have an anchor up front to withstand them. Like if you have a good anchor, you can kind of neutralize them and slow them down at least, even in their kind of like older age, even though they're not like burst. They're not known for burst in their pass rushing. But if you put up a weak anchor in front of them, they can just knock over the that clown balloon doll thing. It's like Calais Campbell, Derek Wolf, they get their big mitts swinging. It's like they'll just knock over those offensive linemen, just devour Joe Burrow. So I'm worried about that for Burrow's side. The Bengals kind of need to give the ball to Joe Mixon a lot, but I'm not optimistic that he'll get very far. So I just kind of see a lot of dead ends for the Bengals, and I think the Ravens would be smart to let those dead ends kind of like work for them, keep Lamar out of harm's way, only really use him as a decoy running threat basically, because Gus Edwards should be able to just stomp over these guys in the middle of the field, and Dobbins should be able to make big plays if they keep giving him the ball. So I don't know what's going on with Ingram. I kind of feel like in a situation like this, the Ravens should feel the pressure to get Edwards and Dobbins going, because Ingram's like a ceremonial starter at this point. Until Edwards starts to lose returns as a runner, they need to keep giving him the ball, I think, when they really need those rushing yards. And then when they're in an in-between state, we know Dobbins is better at like the all-around function than Ingram. And it's basically hubris at this point, I think, for the Ravens to give Ingram the ball too much before it's basically a, you know, running out the clock kind of scenario.
Yeah, they've kind of mismanaged the backfield rotation so far. But I think last week was a step in the right direction, at least when it came to getting Edwards a little bit more involved. I don't know what it means for like J.K. Dobbins's fantasy value right now, because he's been a little bit frustrating relative to, like, you know, you get that first week where you get the two touchdowns and you have like a couple of big plays in the passing game the next week, and then mostly not doing a ton these last couple of weeks. But, you know, if you remove Lamar Jackson's rushing from this offense, and you distribute it to Ingram, to Dobbins, to Edwards, then I think we really start to see this backfield click in a pretty big way. But again, that, you know, you do lose a little bit of the smoke and mirrors effect if the Bengals aren't worried about Lamar Jackson, you know, actually pulling it and then, you know, breaking to the weak side.
It would be a bad setup for the long term. It's just like in this one game, I think we have reason to believe they can get away with it. And because there's these other concerns that they have, they should go for that model, I think.
Yeah. And then, so if that's the case, again, in Lamar Jackson not running it a ton, obviously Mark Andrews had the big bounce back last week. Marquise Brown, to a lesser extent, also looked better than he did against the Chiefs.
Well, Lamar missed DuVernay in a long play, and I'm wondering if you're Harbaugh, you have to look at that play and start thinking about the offense going forward. It's like, well, what do I believe if this pass was on target and DuVernay had a long touchdown? It's like he's better than Boykin.
Boykin's snaps started to come down last week, so I think the Ravens might be listening to you or listening to the podcast, because Boykin's snaps got scaled down pretty drastically last week. I wouldn't say that DuVernay or Prochet's snaps went up by like a significant amount, but like it's enough to where like it's worth noting that Boykin might be trending downwards enough to the point where he might get caught by a DuVernay or a Prochet, and obviously DuVernay probably first in line for that role. But
yeah, he's playing outside.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah, Prochet is probably more of a problem for Snead, which could eventually happen too.
Hey, Snead, 10 for 10 on targets, brother. Still pretty good.
Yeah. But yeah, I think the Ravens in any case should be able to get Gus and Dobbins to just kind of heave them over the finish line while Mixon falls back to earth and Burrow struggles with maybe his worst matchup yet.
Yeah, this could be a long day for Burrow. I think it could look a little bit like the Philly game for him in terms of just like the offensive line just doing him
but
zero
with good
favors.
Corners this time.
Mm-hmm. So that's a tough combo for him to deal with. But, you know, he still might be able to compile up decent enough fantasy stats for you if he drops back like 40 times. All right, let's move on over. We got the Jags going up against the Texans. Bill O'Brien's gone, so that's exciting.
yeah, that's amazing. What a ridiculous team. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I don't think anything can really improve, though. It's like they're going to have to go with the same offensive system. And the system was very much part of the problem, because Bill O'Brien's passing route receiver route combinations were almost like static. Like there's basically nothing dynamic about the way those plays set up. There's nothing to sequence with them, and it's all routes. It's like he was doing the McCarthy and Green Bay thing, where he wants his routes to follow a philosophy of spreading up the field as much, which can be good if you're going against like press man coverage. But if you go against a basic zone defense, you can just kind of let the zone cover each part of the field. And then these receivers are instead just like they're losing all their leverage by breaking away from each other and never crossing each other's routes and never going in motion to throw off the zone alignment. And Romeo Crennel is not in a position to change any of that. I don't know if any of the remaining offensive staff can maybe do something that O'Brien didn't. But it's like one of those moves. Firing Bill O'Brien is, I guess, a necessary good thing for the long term. But I don't know if unless they just start letting Deshaun Watson call hot routes in every single play, I kind of worry that they're going to keep having some of the letdowns that they have had going forward. But in a game like this, I feel like we're more headed toward a shootout just because of how bad the defenses both are. And I've thought this before, but knock on wood, I think Deshaun should be able to have a functional game, just because I just don't know if the Jaguars are more than like a, 25th overall kind of defense right now.
Yeah, that they are kind of a mess, and it maybe a little bit like their week one looking as good as they did against Indianapolis maybe had more to do with Indianapolis's offense than the Jaguars defense. I think that there are clearly some issues still there. I mean, we saw the Bengals game, we saw the Dolphins game, not looking great for that Jags defense. And maybe there's just a bit of revitalization around the morale for the Texans with Bill O'Brien being gone. So I expect them to come out and do well. They are favored by 6, which is a fair bit to trust with this team as currently constructed. Very high over under. So this will be a fun game for DFS. But as far as sides goes, it's hard to trust the Texans with beating somebody by a touchdown even at home, especially after last week. That felt like such a good setup for them to get right. But I guess the other side of that was always going to be, if they don't get right, then this season is probably lost for the Texans, and it ended up being option B. And then on the other side, it's like, do you really trust the Jaguars to go on the road and stay within a touchdown of anybody? So it's,
I don't really, but man, those receivers are really good, and James Robinson is good. And if the over under is sound, then I feel like I like the Jaguars to cover, because that means they're scoring some points, And if they're scoring some points, if they're not bogged down by complete dysfunction, then the Texans' defense isn't very good. So I don't know why they would, stonewall them all of a sudden. It's like Romeo Crennel was running the defense before, and it hasn't really helped them a whole lot. So I like the shootout potential here. I know Gardner Minshew is not that great, and I know the Jags are – both of these teams are kind of dumb in a way that it's always scary to put any wager on them, but – there's legitimate firepower in that Jacksonville offense, and I think I would take the Jags to cover, but I do like David Johnson to have a big game here, even though I don't think he's particularly good anymore.
Okay, that's a good call there. I think David Johnson in the right setting in the year 2020 can still be effective. It's just those settings are much more fewer and far between. He's not nearly like the matchup independent guy that he was in years past. Let's get on over. Got a divisional matchup, hopefully here, between the Chiefs and the Raiders. We'll see how things develop over these next couple of days. But as it stands, Chiefs heavy favorites in this one, 12.5-point favorites. I thought they looked impressive on Monday night. I know that it wasn't a full Patriots team, with the mix of Brian Hoyer and Jarrett Stidham testing that defense as opposed to Cam Newton. So you can only say so much for that. I think you can run on the Chiefs a little bit. So maybe that sets up well for Josh Jacobs. But if they fall behind, which, the Vegas spread here seems to imply, then that might go out the window a little bit, and then you can't really hurt the Chiefs secondary the same way. At least you don't trust Derek Carr to do that. So assuming this one ends up getting played like we said, how do you see this one shaking out?
Yeah, I think the Chiefs kill them, basically. It's going to be It's like you said, the Chiefs do let you run on them sometimes, but part of it is that they really are just letting you. It's part of their model is to basically cut off the sidelines with big, like tall, fast corners like Chavarius Ward, who shut down the sideline in the vertical element. And they try to put those like bumper corners on the outside to push everything inward, where you run into Tyrann Mathieu and Juan Thornhill. So it's tough to throw on them, and it's especially tough to throw down the field. It's like if you're passing on them too, they try to make you kind of like dink and dunk sort of in the middle of the field where it's most hazardous to do that. And it's even in the run game, it's one of those things like they give up maybe a lot of yardage per carry and some chunk yardage time to time. But all they're really trying to do is get you into a second and long or a third and long so they can really let loose the edge rushers and Chris Jones, of course, on the interior. And again, force your quarterback to go into that funnel in the middle of the field. And Derek Carr is already a quarterback who puts a self-constrained sort of funnel into the middle of the field on himself, because yeah. he plays as if those bumpers are there even when they're not. And I think he'll kind of be like at home throwing to that part of the field, but it'll be a very impotent sort of offense that doesn't make any meaningful, like competitive plays really. So, yeah. And even if Jacobs does, you know, get 35 yards on five carries on his first drive, all it takes is him losing 3 yards on one carry where Chris Jones blows up the middle of the line and then the drive's over. And that's how their model works. And it's been working. And the Raiders are the exact type of team that would kind of play into their hands, I think.
So looking at the rest of the Raiders, more in like the long view, I got asked this question on the radio yesterday, but for season long, what do you do with Henry Ruggs at this point?
Well, I think it's worth holding on to him if you can. I guess it's just a question of like how much does it cost you to hold on to him? And I guess in some cases, especially with this COVID nonsense, you might need to cut him to get a starting player into your lineup. So in cases like that, it's like in a normal year, I would just say hold on to him. But I don't know what realistically anyone has at their disposal. I think, you know, his air yardage per snap and what we know he can do after the catch both check out pretty well. It's not going to be fully harnessed even when he's back, because Carr just isn't the type of quarterback to make the most of a player like Ruggs. But it'll be one of those things, like when he's back, if anybody other than Waller is doing anything, it has to be Ruggs who's the heavy favorite, just on the basis of how much air yardage goes to him and how much he tends to do after the catch per catch. And Renfro is in there, of course, he's staying involved, but he's just categorically limited in several ways. And I don't know. I think he loses to Ruggs definitely when Ruggs is back. And it's just the question is like, well, is one of them useful or are they both useless?
That's tough. Not a great setup there in this Raiders offense as currently constructed. So tough stuff there. Before we get on to our next game, we got a couple messages here. We got one from our friends over at Prediction Strike. Prediction Strike is a fantasy sports stock market on which you can buy and sell shares of professional athletes as if they were stocks. Ever heard someone say, "I've had stock in this player since day one"? Well, now Prediction Strike makes that a real possibility. You had stock in Patrick Mahomes' rookie year. You knew this would happen. Now it's reality. Create a portfolio of all your favorite athletes and get closer to the game than ever before. To get started, simply visit PredictionStrike.com to create an account. Then deposit funds to go buy, sell, and hold shares of your favorite players just like you would real stocks. Each game is like an earnings report. If the player beats his projections, his stock moves up. It's that easy. You can trade your shares of players at any time as long as the player isn't currently in a game. Get started today by visiting PredictionStrike.com and sign up with code ROTOWIRE to get an additional $10 with your first deposit of $20 or more. Then we also have a new message from our friends over at StableDuel. Are you dominating your fantasy league? Well, now there's another game you need to play. Imagine fantasy for horse racing. StableDuel is live with daily contests offering thousands of dollars to be won each week. Download the StableDuel app, create your account, and start selecting your horses today. Compete against other players for winner's circle glory and big money prizes. New to racing? Not to worry. StableDuel is simple and fun with low-level entries and big payouts. Name your stable, select 10 horses within your bankroll, and watch each horse accumulate points depending on where they finish. Invite friends to compete against and show them who dominates at all sports, including the sport of kings. Download the StableDuel app and build your stable today. Get in on the action of StableDuel. Play, race, win. All right, let's get on over to the Jets going up against the Cardinals.
The Jets aren't a real team. They're playing the Cardinals. Okay. I just thought they might not be a team anymore.
Okay.
I was wrong. They're playing at home against the Cardinals, and they're down to 7 points, John. They started at 8.5 underdogs, and now they're down to 7, with the over under going from 46.5 to 47. So that's curious. I don't know. The Jets are so weird. I can't. Like, they're just a knuckleball as a team, like a poorly thrown knuckleball. And I don't know, like, is it hubris for us to even try to guess what? I guess Jamison Crowder will happen. But other than that, I don't like Darnold running for that 45-yard touchdown last week has me throwing in the towel. And with that said, I think Cliff looks pretty bad for the Cardinals right now. I'm not sure.
Yeah, what is going on with the Cardinals?
Well, basically, Cliff Kingsbury he's kind of like a guy who's shown up to this game, and he's kind of got like a list of – he's got like a little list of tricks on his sleeve kind of. And he uses these tricks sometimes, and they sometimes work. And he's the only one who has these tricks right now. But it's like they're only succeeding in the first place because they're novel and people haven't seen it yet. And now they're seeing it, and they're saying like, oh, well – now that we know what this looks like, we can make our pieces rearrange such that we'll kind of be sitting where your routes tend to run, which is to say always short, very often in the middle of the field. Cliff tries to run a lot of just kind of like late cascading drag routes, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the theory of it. It makes more sense to me against kind of like zone defenses where it's like you're forcing the defender to look at two different route runners crossing into his zone and pick one. And it makes him, you know, pick wrong every time, basically. Yeah. But against man coverage, is you need players to win more often, and you don't get the same timing. What is that, synchronicity or whatever? Because it's like you get more jams, you get guys thrown off their routes a little bit here and there, and you need to kind of counter the defense when they do that by making the defense pay for creeping upward, and they don't do that. Cliff Kingsbury won't call – I mean, I guess he called a few deep routes with Christian Kirk was getting a few of them. Andy Isabella had a couple earlier. But then last week, it's like 3.7 yards per attempt for Kyler Murray. Like, that's just bad play calling.
I thought that was a typo or something.
By accident, you should be able to get a big play in there. And Kingsbury came up with the precise design – necessary to preempt the possibility of the defense so much as like slipping on a route. And it's because it's predictable, basically. And you can see kind of the hints of it being predictable by all of the receivers running very low depths of target. And by, I should say, Fitzgerald and Hopkins were running very low depths of target targets. And then Kirk and Isabella are at like 20 yards depth of target.
So there's no intermediate.
There's nothing in between. And we know that the long ones aren't being realized actually because they're not landing these targets. So and also DeAndre Hopkins always lines up in the same spot. Christian Kirk always lines up in the same spot. It's always on the left side with Hopkins. So if you're always going to be on the left side, you're never going to motion this guy. You're never going to send other routes to tangle with the coverage of his. Then eventually NFL defensive coordinators will simply find ways to sit on that. And Cliff Kingsbury needs to make an adjustment. And he's shown basically no ability to make any kind of adjustment at all. So he better get on that or else he could be kind of out of here pretty soon because this could get really bad. Like if a defense like last week can do what they did, then Kingsbury could get himself into some really problematic game results coming up. Now, I think he's shown like sparks of insight. Like he's come up with little tricks here and there, usually within the kind of ideological framework that he started with. So it's not truly like he's seeing outside of the box, but he's kind of like seeing different ways within his own box. But he's going to have to take it to the next level and start actually innovating and anticipating and preempting things. And he just hasn't done it yet. So, you know, the Jets defense isn't very good at covering. And I think DeAndre Hopkins, Andy Isabella, Christian Kirk can get open, but I don't know if they would. I literally don't know if Cliff Kingsbury will ask them to get open. I don't know if it'll just be more like more of the same, running three drag routes at the same time and hoping that the defense mixes one of them up and whoops, they didn't. I guess we'll punt again.
Well, I mean, at the maybe Kyler has to start, you know. And it's tough for like a second year player to like overrule his coach, but like maybe he can start calling out the things that he sees, because I mean, if Brett Rypien can throw touchdowns on the Jets, I assume Kyler Murray can throw like four.
Right. But Kyler Murray is awesome. I mean, I think Cliff Kingsbury is clearly holding him back. But it's just like Cliff Kingsbury's offense to this point is kind of like, what if you took four verticals and made it four curls every single play, and all in your philosophy is telling or drags, whatever it is, and you're telling the receivers like, okay, your job is to run the perfect route every play, and according to my theory, if everyone runs the perfect route on every play, somewhere in the defense they will slip up. And it's like, why? If you can run the perfect route every play, and if that's your expectation, and then why can't the defense just perfectly cover it every time? Like, you have to make them, you have to bring surprise into it, you have to bring into some kind of twist. It's just like a slightly, I don't know what you would call it. It's like the Thomas Dimitroff version of trench warfare. Like it's saying like, line up and beat the guy ahead of you. It's like, well, why don't we sneak up on him and hit him from the side instead? Like, what, doesn't that sound easier? And Cliff Kingsbury so far is choosing the first version.
Maginot line Cliff over here. Not good.
He's got to grow a dang noggin or something. Like he's operating like he's just using like a sheet of answers, and he doesn't know what the answers mean or why they are listed there. And
he's got the wrong test.
Yeah,
just like Animal House. we would be remiss. I mean, we've talked about this game for a couple minutes. Not a single mention of Joe Flacco, Mario. Come on.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, Darnold's not even playing. I don't know.
All we had to do is mention him. That was the only quota that I needed.
I'm leaving.
Okay.
I don't know. I guess I think Murray should have a good game because the Jets aren't really built to cover three, four decent receivers on a play, and Flacco sucks. So I don't know. I don't want to pick the Cardinals to cover seven, but man, Flacco is going to look really bad.
Yeah, I can't believe Flacco never struck me as a guy that was like really gung ho about football. So the fact that he's hanging on this long after his prime, other than, and like he already got paid like insanely. So what even is the point? Why would you do this? Why would you go play for the Jets?
It's some kind of like axe to grind for him. It's like he knows everybody groans when he gets steps on the field now. So now out of spite, he tries to play forever.
I guess. He does have elite hair among the quarterbacks, but that's about all he's got going for him at this stage.
Should be good for Crowder. That's all I really think about the Jets, though.
Okay. And then when Darnold gets back, though, we mentioned Jeff Smith earlier. Can Jeff Smith be a thing?
Well, he's a really good athlete, and he hasn't played receiver very long, so could happen.
Okay.
He had really promising results in that first game, which – you know, easy opponent or not, fluky or not, it's kind of impressive to do that sort of, you know, showing up to the team like 3 days earlier. But yeah, he's pretty dang fast and quick and stuff. So something to work with there, at least, unlike Hogan.
Yeah, I put a fab bid on him in NFFC, but I also had one. It was a contingency one in case I didn't get Gabriel Davis, but I got Gabriel Davis. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah, Jeff Smith can run. We know that.
Yes.
Much.
Yes. All right. And I guess Le'Veon Bell being back, we got to mention that.
Ugh. God, everything is just annoying about that team. Hate them.
Groanage. Okay. All right. Enough of that one then. Let's get on over to the Eagles going up against the Steelers. I groan when it comes to the Eagles. I think that they're just not very fun to watch. And like I don't know what the heck that Sunday night game was, but they ended up winning it. I mean, the Mullins picks were just dreadfully bad, unbelievably bad.
That was the worst one ever, man. Yeah. That Singleton one.
Yeah.
That was just the worst interception. And I know there's like some surprisingly bad interceptions that someone could go dig up, and like or one where a guy probably says like, I'm going to throw this to you, and then throws it to him, something insane like that. But other than saying, hey, Alex, I'm throwing this ball to you, like that's the only way that play could have been worse. I don't understand how, like, Mullins let me down too, because I thought he was better than that, and wow, he is not.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, they hammered it home during the broadcast, but it's like he needs to be if you have like the training wheels on him and he's just playing within the structure of the Shanahan system, he can kind of make it work well enough. And the second he gets outside of it, it goes to hell immediately.
And I'm not inclined to give the Eagles defense a ton of credit for that one.
No.
So I totally understand the spread here.
Beathard moved the ball on them at the end.
And Beathard sucks.
Yes.
Is the thing. Beathard was, he is still, I think, worse than Mullins. But it's like Mullins was just so insanely bad. And the Eagles defense, in any case, I don't think looks especially intimidating for the Steelers offense. Like that, I do have some fear that Roethlisberger just isn't quite. Not necessarily like his arm is wrong in any way, but it's like he's just not in the rhythm. He's not in the mood for throwing deep. And you have to go deep eventually, and you can't bank on that Claypool yards after the catch scenario happening when you need it to. So I'd like to see the depth of target go up on basically everybody, but especially Juju Smith-Schuster and Diontae Johnson and James Washington, especially James Washington, I guess I should say, because he's not even throwing deep to James Washington. And it's like, how do you not – isn't that the only thing he does? But they're not doing
that. So is Claypool going to overtake him then?
I don't think so, really. I mean, I think James Washington is still as good as he's been. It's just that Roethlisberger isn't throwing the same throws that he used to, and there might be some reason in the matchups or the play calling of the defenses that would explain that.
We also just have less sample with the Steelers. Like, it's really hard to, especially with so many unknowns about the Steelers coming into this year, because we didn't know how Roethlisberger would gel with these guys coming off the injury and everything. Having one less game to analyze, it makes the Steelers all the more difficult to read on the offensive side, I think.
Yeah, and they didn't seem to have a clear identity before any of this, the last time they've been playing. I mean, so it's one of those things, like, we know what the Steelers have looked like for a long time, and they don't quite look that way yet. And there's a simple fact, like, they can't keep throwing passes this short forever. Like, somebody's got to start going downfield, because Roethlisberger is going to have these short routes sat on by somebody. Like, maybe they're giving them a lot of cushion, and maybe that's why he keeps taking them. I don't know. But you can't keep producing with these sort of peripheral stats, you know? So something's got to give. I think it will be that Roethlisberger throws deeper. It's a little bit of a question in this game, just because the Eagles do have a legitimately good front four. Like, their pass rush is definitely one of the better ones in the league in terms of at least their four down linemen. So that could be a concern for most teams. I just don't know if it is for the Steelers, because they have one of the better offensive lines. So if that strength neutralizes one of the Eagles' primary strengths, then we're just down to a game where, like, even if Ben Roethlisberger is something other than good, Carson Wentz just kind of doesn't have anything going for him on the other side. Like, he doesn't have the good line to neutralize what is an even better pass rush than the Eagles one in the Pittsburgh defense, of course. So I feel like that spread at seven, holding at seven, makes sense, even as the over-under drops 3 points. Because I just don't know what the Eagles can even theoretically do in this game.
Can the Eagles catch a little bit of crap for the kind of doing like a worse impression of something that was a terrible idea to begin with from Lamar Jackson's rookie year, where they would bring split Flacco out wide and bring Lamar Jackson? And at least Carson Wentz looks like he kind of wants to be out there during those plays. But this like Jalen Hurts stuff, it doesn't do good for anybody.
Yeah, it's just one of those cases of a team not thinking something through and kind of fixating on the wrong logic. Like, they look at Jalen Hurts in the pre-draft process and they conclude the true conclusion, like, hey, he's a pretty good prospect. He seems like a good football player. You know, we could always use more good football players. And it's like, well, in the one sense, sure, you could always use more good football players, but how good are they for you if you don't know how to use them?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're getting in this point where they're like, oh, we really got to get a return on this guy. He's pretty good after all. Like, he's a good player. It's like, yeah, but you don't have the infrastructure to, like, use him in any way. So it doesn't matter. And they're kind of, instead of accepting the fact that they can't use him, they're trying to get the worst of both worlds, basically, by, you know, throwing off Wentz's rhythm, forfeiting the pass threat, and putting Hurts on the field for these impotent run threat plays that do nothing to throw off the defense. Like, that's like the play that all those guys used to defend the most in high school and college.
Yeah, they like breathe a sigh of relief when that formation comes out.
Yeah, it's like going back to first grade for a few plays. It's just it's a ridiculous idea. The only way that the Eagles could leverage that in a useful way is if it adds an actual layer of deception by fitting into the broader offense, which they don't. They come out and say, like, they think, like, oh, if it's a new look, you won't know what's happening then, right? And it's like, no, we can tell that you can only do this one thing because that's the equipment you have on the field right now. And so we won't worry about the other stuff because you can't do any of the other stuff. And I think they're learning that, but it's just kind of annoying when coaches have to relearn these things. It's like, come on, you know, putting a gimmick play on the field that you broadcast ahead of – it's like telling them ahead of time that you're going to do a trick play. It makes no sense.
It's insanely dumb. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Headphone cut out for a second. Sorry. Is there any piece of this Eagles passing game that you can kind of sell yourself on? And then also, what do you do with Miles Sanders right now?
Well, Sanders has kind of like a bad matchup, but I think so much usage might funnel toward him that he should be fine. And in PPR, I can imagine him having something like 6 catches for, you know, 40 yards or something like that in this game. Just because if that spread is correct, then the Steelers will get a lead such that the Eagles will start to throw a lot. And the Eagles receivers are still beat up. They're probably not very good, even if they are healthy. And Sanders is going to get targets. I would imagine anyway that the Steelers will first concern themselves with Zach Ertz. So I guess one of Ertz or Sanders has to do something in the passing game and PPR just because Wentz is going to have to throw passes. And if Wentz throws 40 passes and he completes, you know, 22 of them, it's like, do we think John Hightower and J.J. Arcega-Whiteside are combining for 10 of those? It's like, no. So Sanders has to do something. It might not be like that efficient of a game from scrimmage for him.
We need more Travis Fulgham is really the answer.
Yeah, I mean, he's got something. I think that was a fluke play, basically, but they're desperate, so they're going to keep going back to him until he fails, I think.
Yep, it's just like that for Philly. Time a flat circle, of course. Let's move on over. We'll hit this one quickly because I'm not super confident that this game even happens, but Bills-Titans, a lot of stuff flying around as of Thursday morning about this one. Not going to get into that too much here, but if this one gets played, just a quick and dirty, how do you see it unfolding?
I guess I would pick the Bills, but
Bills look good, man.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the Tennessee secondary doesn't have anyone who can cover right now either. So
and they can't stop the run at all.
They can't stop the run that well. I think they have the personnel to do that, but it's not happening yet. It would be kind of interesting to see Jayon Brown spying Josh Allen a little bit. I wonder if that could maybe slow him in the running game, and I wonder if that would throw off their formula at all, if so. But, yeah, I don't think the game happens. I think this is probably going to get written down as a forfeit that the Bills get.
Wow, yeah.
Because Mike Vrabel, that guy had to have known that he might have even directed it. That the team would do something like that. So because he's one of those guys, one of those types of guys. Don't really need to talk about them, but he is one of those types of guys. And yeah, I mean, it's not fair to the Bills to you know, deprive them of the opportunity to get a win in a game where they probably would. And Titans got to pay.
Yep, I agree. Let's get on over. We got the Rams going up against the football team. The Rams have basically just – this is their third game in the Eastern time zone so far out of 5 games.
Getting them ready for the moving franchise.
Yeah, let the Chargers just have that SoFi Stadium or whatever the heck it is. Anyway, so the football team made an interesting change, and we talked about this off air, but Haskins coming off, you know, a game where he showed a pulse finally, and it was against a good team, the Ravens challenging secondary, and for Haskins to do as well as he did, I thought was an encouraging sign. So for him to get benched, you put it this way when we were talking, it almost feels scheduled that Haskins gets pulled after the fourth week.
Yeah, it was scheduled in like a play it by ear scheduling thing. Like Ron Rivera knew perfectly well he was going to go into this year looking for a reason to bench Dwayne Haskins. He couldn't just do it at the outset because that would correctly draw criticism. So he needs Dwayne Haskins to go out there and fail so he can create the pretext for putting in this guy that he would have in his own perfect universe have just started in week one, which is Kyle Allen. Now, I don't know why Ron Rivera thinks Kyle Allen is so great, but Ron is wrong, and Ron is wrong just as on a personal level for doing things this way. This is a team that has a lot of reason to feel defeated, and Ron Rivera traditionally does a good job of earning the respect and admiration of his players, getting them to play hard. But can he do that in a Dan Snyder organization after he just benched the guy who by most accounts was preferred by the pass catchers on that team? It's like Steven Sims and Terry McLaurin obviously like Dwayne Haskins. And this is important. Kyle Allen is worse. Allen will not make anything better. And so if you tell these guys they have to go out there and play through a plague for Dan Snyder's money and go watch the guy who was probably like a friend of theirs go not only from the starter, but basically kicked off the team because Ron Rivera didn't want to deal with him anymore because he was just inconvenienced by it. Like, think about this. Like, the Ron Rivera is going up to this guy and benching him for having his best game of the year and the toughest matchup of the year so far. And do you think that Dwayne Haskins is not entitled to reacting in a negative way? Because I think he is. I think Dwayne Haskins has every right to feel, you know, aggrieved by this. And I think that Ron Rivera probably was in some way setting the bait so he could go like, oh, well, you're reacting very immaturely, and so now I have to make Alex Smith the backup too. It's like he just wanted to get Dwayne Haskins off the team, and this is the best pretext he could think of for doing it. And on some conscious level, I bet Ron doesn't think any of this is true. Like he probably on some level convinced himself like, oh, I gave him every chance. But people are good at lying to themselves. People in this culture are really great at laundering their ulterior motives and convincing themselves like, no, I'm the good guy. I'm not up to any funny business here. Whereas I just think someone more honest than Ron would have said at the start of the year, like, look, Kyle Allen's my quarterback. I don't care. We're not having a competition because Kyle's my guy. I'm not interested in a competition if it means that I don't get to start Kyle. So we're not having a competition. Dwayne Haskins, if you want a release or you want a trade request, that's fair. I'll try to trade you or cut you. But instead, he wanted to play it the way such that he's not the bad guy because that's his main thing, is convincing everyone that he's not the bad guy. And I don't think that anyone will buy it. I don't think that this team is good enough or has enough to play for to stay, you know, like disciplined, impartial soldiers throughout it all. So I think that Terry McLaurin's amazing. He'll be fine. Antonio Gibson's coming to life a little bit. Yes. This stuff about how like Kyle Allen's going to improve the offense and he's going to make Antonio Gibson and Christian McCaffrey. It's like, man, Mike Davis is already Christian McCaffrey. Is it just that it was the Panthers or something about the team there, like, or just the choice of setting up an offense that way? And like it's not that Kyle Allen was the key to unlocking. It's Christian McCaffrey broke out with Cam Newton too. It's not going to happen. And also Antonio Gibson is not Christian McCaffrey. So that whole thing is dumb. The offense might not get worse because it was already pretty close to the basement level. But this is the worst offensive line I can remember seeing. And Kyle Allen is a quarterback who got benched at the University of Houston for Kyle Postma, who I think they moved to receiver after that or played receiver before that. So Kyle Allen was really bad last year in Carolina. He has a tougher task in this setting. And he's got, you know, bad karma riding on him, basically. Like there's nothing legitimate about this, and that matters. There's going to be kind of a political cost to behaving this way if you're Ron Rivera.
That was a great rant. I really enjoyed that. That was good stuff. I mean, Hard to really add anything on to that. That summed it up pretty succinctly as far as the state of being for this Washington football team. For our purposes, how does this set up for the Rams? It feels like a hollow question.
I think it'll be a good game for the Rams offense. I mean, the Washington defensive line is still a problem, but it's the only problem in that defense, so you can kind of single them out.
They can work around that, yeah.
Yeah, you can just put extra resources towards stopping them. And these corners, I don't think, can cover these receivers, and especially when you throw in the McVay trickery variable. It could be any of Cooper Kupp, Robert Woods, Tyler Higbee. Any of them could have a pretty big game. More than one of them could have a pretty big game. I think Daryl Henderson bounces back after a dud last week. I don't really know what happened there, but I wouldn't really be that surprised if McVay was just kind of not using the full playbook.
I think the Rams just kind of took their foot off the gas that entire game. Like, that was not a good game from the Rams. They sleptwalked.
Yeah, I mean, I really feel like McVay was not trying quite as much. Not because he was looking forward to the Washington game next week, but I think he just kind of knew a harmless opponent when he saw one. And I guess there's a similar risk here. Like, maybe Goff doesn't have a big game because they don't use any of his cool tricks. But I think even Goff, as long as that offensive line gives him like 3 seconds, I think even Goff without much trickery can beat that secondary.
I think so too, especially with the weapons that he has around him. And then, of course, hopefully Darrell Henderson looks more like the guy he was in weeks 2 and 3 than week 4. I think he can be. So should set up well for him as a bounce back. Let's get on over. We got the Dolphins going across the country to face the 49ers. Niners, crazy injury report still. What's that?
I will not be playing CJ Beathard, but I do like the 49ers to... I guess 9 points is a lot, but I think I still take that one.
Yeah, the Dolphins are in pretty rough shape, and I think Tua is still a ways away from starting, right? So I guess my big question when it comes to the Dolphins side, what's going on with Preston Williams? I'm seeing, you know, people saying that Isaiah Ford is now the wide receiver two in Miami. What's going on there?
It's just the returns haven't been there for Williams. Maybe he's shaking off some rust from the ACL, but he's their wide receiver too if he's healthy. I don't know maybe there's been kind of unreported details. Maybe his knee's swelling up a little bit, stuff like that. But Devontae Parker, the other thing is just like, it's unfair to compare or hold to the standard of a player like Devontae Parker when you're talking about a guy who was undrafted last year. So, and coming off an ACL tear, of course, at midseason. So Devontae Parker's just really good, and it's going to be borderline impossible for any particular receiver on that team to compete with him, especially if they're still working their ACL back into shape. So I think it's like, at once, Parker's creating like an unrealistic ideal for the Williams investors, and also like, he's just kind of had a few fluky outcomes. Point Ford's pretty good, but he plays a different position. Like, it's if he's their second wide receiver, it's because they've gone to a permanent wide receiver three set offense. And I don't think they'll do that. Durham Smith plays too much for that to be the case. So I think, Preston Williams is going to be their wide receiver two pretty safely by the end of the year. The question is just like, what kind of utility does he provide in that capacity? Because it might not be that much. The second leading receiver, especially if you're talking third leading receiver behind Gesicki, then on a team like the Dolphins, that might not be much value.
Right. So that's the concern that I'm starting to have there. And then on the Niners side, starting to get healthy in the receiving core. I think the running back situation is still a little bit up in the air as far as Mostert is concerned. But between Brandon Ayuk and Deebo Samuel, are those guys that you can feel comfortable starting?
I think I would feel comfortable about Deebo. I'm a little skeptical of Ayuk still. Like, I know he's very explosive, but I see people altering their projections for him based on being like, oh, wow, he looks fast. It's like, we knew he was fast. I didn't, like, in no way did I mean to question how fast or explosive he was. It was more like, I think he needs to have structured, like, scripted plays to get involved, because I don't know if he really creates – kind of like Deebo Samuel. Like, I don't think Deebo Samuel's quite – the creator that people kind of assumed that he was coming out of South Carolina. But if you set up situations like Kyle Shanahan can, then yeah, he'll be good because he's an explosive athlete. And that's definitely what I thought of Ayuk. And a few big plays doesn't change that. Now, if he starts showing really good route running and just, you know, getting corners to twist their ankles when he's running slants and stuff like that, then that would be something that I would really need to recalibrate everything, because it's like, man, if Ayuk is as explosive as he is and now he's running routes really well, it's like that's a really good receiver right there. But for now, I think he's not as good as Debo, and I think both of them are safely behind Kittle. So if I'm wondering like how much value I expect from the third pass catcher in a CJ Beathard offense, it's probably not that much. But as like tournament plays in DFS and in fantasy, with all the nonsense going on, the injuries and the COVID, it's like I can imagine quite a few scenarios where you would want Ayuk in your lineup. It's just, I think it's one of those things where you have to be resigned to the reality that, you know, maybe this doesn't work. Maybe it's just the best option that I have.
Right. Yeah. High upside, but plenty of risk along with it. Let's get on over to the Colts going up against the Browns. Colts 2-point favorites on the road. Browns down Nick Chubb, of course. So leading off there, how do you think that the Browns, I mean, they ended up scoring a ton of points. I think Dallas definitely helped them with that. But what does this offense look like without Nick Chubb? Like, does Kareem Hunt, how much bigger does his role get? The diminishing returns now with you know, your RB2 not being Kareem Hunt anymore, and now it's D'Ernest Johnson. What does it look like for this Browns offense?
I don't know, and I don't know if they know either, because it seems like this groin injury that Hunt has isn't a really big deal. Like, maybe he feels it a little bit, but it doesn't seem like it's changing their approach a whole lot. But we might kind of see something like Kareem Hunt takes Nick Chubb's previous role, which is to say with less pass catching, and D'Ernest Johnson takes the Kareem Hunt role, because D'Ernest Johnson was a pass catching specialist coming into the NFL. And I know he had the big rushing performance last week, but his whole deal was like he was a pass catching specialist at South Florida when Marlon Mack was the starter, and he was always really good at it. Like it's like him and Treston Ebner basically are the only running backs I can think of who were like this, where they basically just caught passes, and he was really good at it on a team that was bad at throwing the ball. So I think D'Ernest Johnson has some skill as a guy, you know, in the open field. He's pretty slow, but he seems to have the knowledge and like the innate instincts of just playing football in the open field. So he could do the pass catching stuff that Hunt did before Chubb got hurt. And maybe they say, well, now Hunt, we need you to take the 20 carries because Chubb can't anymore, because they're not just going to start throwing the ball. Like, Baker Mayfield can't, and they don't have any good receivers after Odell Beckham and Jarvis Landry. I do still think Taywan Taylor is better than Kadarius Hodge, who they put on IR, but they don't notice that. So it's not like I have reason to believe they'll feature Taylor. And if they did feature Taylor, I will say it would give them a new speed element on the other side opposite Odell Beckham that could maybe create new possibilities for everyone. I just am not convinced that Stefanski notices things like this.
Okay. All right. So there will not, in your mind, be like any sort of like philosophical change. I mean,
Can't throw the ball, you know, like it's like if they have to run the ball or else they kind of just forfeit categorically the way Baker Mayfield is playing this year.
I guess, I mean, you're right. I've definitely just like vacillate on my opinions of Baker Mayfield's ability to stick as a starting quarterback in the NFL. But yeah, I mean, one of those touchdowns last week was not him throwing it. It was Jarvis Landry.
This could be an ugly game because Rivers sucks on the other side, and that Cleveland pass rush could – they have four really good down linemen who could cause problems for any O-line, I think, including the Colts. So I could see that this being like an under game, basically, where both sides are completely grounded.
Yeah, I think so too. That this should be an ugly one, especially no Nick Chubb on the one side for the Browns being such a huge factor, and then Phillip Rivers being an anchor on the Colts offense too. When it comes to the Colts, though, I mean, let's get into their fantasy relevant guys quickly. Between Jonathan Taylor, T.Y. Hilton, Mo Alie-Cox, how does it look for them?
Well, Mo Alie-Cox is their best tight end, but Frank Reich doesn't know it, so there's no guarantee that he'll ever realize it. I'm going with Mo Alie-Cox in a couple leagues, but it's just because I think he's an exceptional talent. It's like I know that the role could be quite constricting to him. So, but sometimes you just don't have any better alternatives. With that said, I don't really like the setup for T.Y. Hilton just because I don't know if Rivers can get him the ball. And I think Denzel Ward is exactly the kind of corner who Hilton does not want to see. Beyond that, maybe Michael Pittman can get a good look here or there, I guess.
He's still dinged up, isn't he? Or he had the compartment.
Oh, crap. Yeah. So Zach Pascal is the slot guy. Nothing obvious with the matchup there, but it's like one of those things. I don't think Rivers can throw the ball to Hilton if he's open. I think he would sooner throw to Pascal covered than Hilton open on the outside. And it all sounds ugly to me. I don't really want to wager on any of it, but I do think, you know, Taylor's going to go off one of these games. I just don't know if a defensive line like the Browns is the ideal setting, especially if they keep trying, if they keep getting like crowded boxes and they think like, oh, well, we got to throw because that's what you would do if you had a good quarterback. But it's like you don't have a good quarterback, so I don't know what going to Rivers really gets you there. I almost feel like they'd be better off just giving Taylor 20 carries, giving Jordan Wilkins 12, and giving Hines like 6, just because I think Rivers, the more he throws, the more likely that he's going to get hit throwing, turn the ball over, take sacks, things like that.
Yeah, it's very weird how Indianapolis is playing ball this year.
If they had Cam on their team, they'd be like a Super Bowl. They'd be like an AFC Championship favorite.
Then the hype would have made sense.
Yeah.
Signing Philip Rivers never made sense to have them be as hyped as they were coming into the season. He's so, so bad. I'm getting heated. Let's get on over. Giants, Cowboys. The Cowboys are putting up a lot of points, at least. They're sort of like a supercharged version of like the Bucks from last year or something, where they are just an amusement park of
they're like NFL Texas Tech.
It's really fun. For our purposes, I can't imagine being a Cowboys fan is very fun right now, but for our purposes, it's dandy. I love the way that things have been going. But what do you make of this game?
Well, I guess Devontae Freeman has a nice setup. I think he's clearly the best running back they have, but I can't tell if I care just because that's such a low bar. And I do think Freeman is more or less washed up. It's just like, you know, it's easy to look good when you're running next to Deion Lewis and Wayne Gallman. So I'm not really inclined to get my hopes up too high there. But if you have him as a flex option this week, I think this is one of your better setups as far as Freeman specifically goes. Daniel Jones has to bounce back here. I think Daniel Jones was a terrible draft pick. I am still pretty surprised at how bad he's been this year, and I would be completely floored if he doesn't bounce back in this setting. So I think he'll be good. I think you got to like Slayton, probably Evan Ingram, I guess. I don't know what the latest is on Shepard. If Shepard were back, you'd feel better about Jones even more. But honestly, I think CJ Board could get open on this Dallas defense. I don't think it matters who they have at receiver.
Yeah, I think so too. It's crazy how bad that Dallas defense has been. But then for the Giants part, defensively, they are obviously in a really tough spot. Have you been able to like find any sort of rhythm to the way in which one of these Cowboys receivers is the wide receiver one on a given week?
Cooper. It's just he's the best of the three, and he runs the most kind of practical route. Like Gallup's the guy who's always going to be playing the sideline, playing more downfield probably than Cooper is, and certainly more than Lamb is in the slot. But honestly, the way the Dallas defense is right now, it really might just kind of be all three most of the time. Mm-hmm. But Cooper's the one who will be least volatile, Gallup the one who is most volatile. But I think also you would say like Gallup is the one most likely, or Gallup is the one more likely between himself and Lamb to have like a 30-point-plus day.
Totally.
The trade-off being that Gallup is also more likely of the two to have a 4-point day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of framing it. And then this might be Zeke's best game of the year, I think, setup-wise.
Yeah, based on the spread and the kind of, this is a 1-3 team, you might worry about a 3-1 team giving Zeke the second half off in it with a 10-point favored status, but I don't think a 1-3 team will do that.
No, I don't think so either, so look for him to get fed. Let's get on over. We got a couple more games to get to. Broncos, Patriots. Patriots having played the the Chiefs this past week. Still not totally sure what's going on with this game, but as it stands, Patriots 5-point favorites in this one. So that I assume that's a line that suggests that Cam is not playing.
Cam can't play. I guess there's that asymptomatic technicality. It sounds insane to me to let a guy who tested positive play in a game, and I don't know, man. These people are insane. I don't know what they are doing, and I don't know how much, you know, epidemiologist input is going into any of it, but I don't think Cam can play. I don't think they can play Hoyer. They got to go with Stidham, and I think Stidham is just garbage, so that tells you where they're at. I don't like putting 11 points on a team with Stidham starting, you know. I don't care how bad the other team is.
No. I was tweeting out on Monday night, like, come on, Bill. Let us see Stidham. Let's see how bad it is.
Man, Hoyer was playing like an idiot in that game. And he is like a 15-year veteran.
I know.
Just playing like an infant. Unbelievable. But yeah, Stidham, on the other hand, is just brutal to watch. It's like all the terror of Duck Hodges, but with none of the moxie to make up for it. And I think that at once – Brett Rypien will get torn to shreds by this Patriots defense. I don't think he finishes the game. I think they go back to Driscoll, but
or Bortles.
Yeah, or Bortles. Honestly, they never should have gone away from Driscoll. Like, I know he's not good, but Rypien is worse.
Rypien played with moxie against the Jets. Like, I think you can at least say that. I think that he's deserving of an NFL job as a backup in some capacity. Probably should be your third string, but. The longer that game went on and the more opportunities that he was out there to show his true self, it became more and more evident that he was just not cut out for starting and leading an NFL team. So, yeah, they should go back to Driscoll. I'm with you where Driscoll, not great, certainly, but I think he's at least a competent backup.
And they should just utilize him as a runner because yes. I know that he can't throw very well, but that we've seen this happen over and over. If you leverage his running ability, you make the defense play the pass less seriously, and then a worse passer can throw on the defense now. So, but yeah, unless they do that, I guess they're just wasting time. But yeah, they're gonna have to give Gordon the ball a lot, and I think they will. So I guess I kind of like the Broncos to cover just because I almost think this is one of those games where they could be hopeless, dominated. Start to finish in all four quarters and still only lose by like 8.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely see that as a possibility. And when it comes to the Patriots, can you make some sense out of Damian Harris?
I thought Harris was fine in that game. I didn't really see much that was conclusive in any way. It's like he ran hard, he got yardage that was available. So it's kind of checking the box, but I don't know if there's really any conclusions that we can run with other than they'll give him the ball if there are rushing attempts to give out, and he'll run hard. You know, he doesn't leave yardage on the field. I guess what we wait to see now is, can he get involved as a pass catcher, which he didn't in the last game, and can he show us some second and third moves? Because we saw him do the run straight ahead as hard as you can move, and I know at Alabama he made some elusive plays. So I guess I think he has more that he can do. I just don't want to be like too presumptuous.
Okay, all right, that makes sense. Let's get on over to the Vikings going up against the Seahawks, the Sunday night matchup. We got the Seahawks 7-point favorites in this one. Vikings obviously showed some pulse, some life last week. You know, the offense I think can have, you know, some success. I mean, you have Adam Thielen working. You have Dalvin Cook as obviously one of the best running backs in the league. Justin Jefferson coming on really, really strong is a huge development for them. It's just a matter of, sorry, man, your defense is – nobody's defense is going to stop the Seahawks this year. And if anyone is, it's definitely not the Vikings.
Yeah, I guess 7 points and before that 9 points might have been asking a lot of the Seahawks. But Minnesota's corners are – Cam Dantzler and Jeff Gladney, two rookies. Mike Hughes, their other corner, isn't very good. Holton Hill, it's bad. So I think Lockett can just run endless circles around these guys. Holton Hill and Cam Dantzler are built to match up with DK Metcalf, but particularly in Dantzler's case, he doesn't have the athleticism to match with DK Metcalf. And yeah, it's like he can probably keep Chris Carson under control, but those two receivers are just, you know, total ace cards to pull on pretty much any defense, let alone one starting two overmatched rookies at corner.
Yeah, so that's just going to be too much. So if this does set up as a game script where the Vikings are playing from behind, what does that do as far as your interest in Thielen or Jefferson for this week?
See, I don't know, because I like those two. I definitely think they're good players, and Justin Jefferson, interestingly, is not playing slot receiver. He's playing outside. So that's kind of interesting that he's not playing the slot anymore. He's going to keep getting these downfield shots, apparently. I don't know if these – it looks like Quentin Dunbar might be out again. If he's out, then Justin Jefferson or Thielen, whoever they put on the left side, can run away from Trey Flowers, no doubt in my mind. So that matchup should be available to them at all times. And I don't know, Cook should run on them. The Seattle defense is a bit beat up in general, I should mention. So Cook should be going. Cook obviously has that kind of game takeover possibility. He can do that kind of stuff, and I don't see any reason why he couldn't against a defense like this. It's just like the way I imagine it going wrong is if they get taken out of that setup, if they basically have to go three wide, four wide, something like that, then I worry about Kirk Cousins turning into a pumpkin, because he can only – I only see easy or a consistent success for him if he's kind of setting up comfortably in a run viable – a formation that's both run and pass viable, and kind of isolating on Trey Flowers in the passing game and then letting Dalvin do the lifting otherwise. Because if they have to switch the script to we take a little bit of the load off Dalvin and we start attacking Shaq Griffin, then I get a little concerned, because as much as Thielen and maybe even Jefferson too can beat Griffin, Griffin can get some victories too, whereas with Flowers, I think he just loses almost every single time. And if they keep it in their offensive terms, like if they keep their kind of balanced setup, I think they should be consistent. But if they fall too far behind, I worry about Cousins doing like the Colts game, I guess.
And this is in prime time. You know what that means?
Stupid Kirk?
Yes. Like famously okay. Stupid Kirk. And, I mean, we even saw it in Seattle last year.
Yeah, I am a little worried about it, because, again, if he gets taken off of his script, he just falls apart.
Yeah. It gets really bad for him on prime time, and then also like you said, more actionably, when he's asked to bring a team back, that's when the wheels really fall off for that Vikings team. And the defense being as bad as they are going into a road game against an offense that's clicking as hard as the Seahawks, it's a really huge ask for Cousins and the Vikings here on Sunday night. Let's round it out. Monday night, Chargers, Saints, one of the weirder Monday night matchups I can remember. Just not a ton of buzz about this one. The Saints got the win in Detroit last week. The Chargers did not play well, obviously, in Tampa this past week. They have no Austin Eckler now. That definitely stings. But it looks like, you know, I'm eating my words a little bit, at least so far as the Justin Herbert experience is going thus far. But still, I think the Saints are just too quality here to really fall to the Chargers at home, especially if they're able to get Michael Thomas back.
Yeah, 7.5 points seems like a lot to me, though. I think the Chargers defense is pretty legit, and I do worry that they're the kind of defense that Breeze might specifically struggle with, just because they're more built to stop that intermediate and underneath than they are to stop the deep ball. So if Breeze can't threaten the deep ball, that's not just a way that he can't beat them, but it's also a reason for the Chargers to focus that much more in the part of the field where Breeze is dependent and already maybe at like a little bit of a disadvantage here. But yeah, it's asking Herbert a lot to win on the road. They're still not letting him really cut loose either. They probably should have been throwing more aggressively against the Buccaneers, because Herbert basically played great. He played better than Brady, but they were keeping the sample size small, and so the ball bounced the wrong way, and they were the losers of that one, because it was like, you know, you might have had a chance to score an extra touchdown or catch up sooner in the game if you had thrown a little more aggressively, but there was just too much of a – they wanted to protect Herbert, understandably, but I don't think you can. I think you need to let him try to score. You protect him by having him not fall behind and letting the defense just, you know, focus on the pass rush. You help him by keeping the game balanced on offense. And Keenan Allen, I mean, I don't think anyone can cover him on that Saints defense at all. So if Allen is working, then I think Herbert can more or less work. And I'm not taking it as a given that Breeze gets much going. So Kamara, Murray, they really got to bail him out. The Saints defense needs to step up. I feel like 7.5 is too much.
Yeah, 7.5, definitely a big number for this Saints offense to cover as currently constructed. If Thomas is back and things are working a little bit better through the air, then maybe things get sorted out and they're able to cover a number that big. Maybe the loss of Eckler ends up being a bigger impact than we are expecting or than this line seems to imply. But either way, I'm with you there. But that's going to round things out for today's show. From Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening to the RotoWire NFL podcast. And check back Friday for Andrew Laird and Scott Jenstad breaking down the DFS slate for this weekend. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.